This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Hello, hello.
What's up?
Hey.
How's it going?
It's a little chilly.
Did you get snow?
We didn't get snow, but it's cold and it's been raining. Three people died in a tornado a few miles south of us.
Jeez.
On Monday. So pretty lucky that didn't hit us.
Wow. We've been pretty simple. Just think 7 inches of snow or something in Missouri, but no power outages, at least where I'm at. And things have been like pretty good for us, luckily. It has been a crazy week.
Monday, we got 5.5 inches. And then we had another one Wednesday. It hasn't been above freezing like a week. And so luckily, very luckily in Tennessee, it's not what it is in Texas. But we also still don't know how to handle that stuff here in Memphis either. So we were planning on driving tonight and going to like pick up some food and bring it back. And then they shut all the restaurants down because there's a water boil order and no one trusts the restaurants, I guess, to actually boil their water. Anyway, yeah.
Thoughts and prayers to people in Texas and every state that's affected.
Yeah, I can't imagine what that's like. Shifting gears, we are very fortunate to have Mike Perrin with us from Sidekick fame and Factory fame and overall just Ruby community. So hello, Mike. And if you wouldn't mind, just maybe giving a kind of brief introduction.
Thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be here. Yeah, I'm Mike Perrin of Ruby and Sidekick and Factory fame. Yeah, longtime Ruby open source fellow who started the Sidekick project and sort of accidentally found a way to business success through building it and then building actual commercial products on top of it. It's been an interesting 9-year journey so far, but I have no plans to stop anytime soon.
Yeah, I was curious, like, what were you doing before you started Sidekick and what led into the idea and all of that, the early days?
I did a number of open source Ruby projects before Sidekick. I was the main maintainer of the Memcached client for doing sort of, you know, high performance caching. And so I got a pretty good in-depth knowledge of networking and profiling and optimization there. And also as part of my job, I was doing a lot of back-end Ruby services and I found myself building background job systems. I think I built 2 or 3 of them before I came around to Sidekick. And so Sidekick was my 3rd or 4th go at building a background job system. And I just decided I wanted to build one for the community, like the best one I could, and sort of radically improve the efficiency of what was out there. Before you had Delayed Job came out and then Rescue came out. And those were single-threaded, process-oriented. So Sidekick was the first one that used threads. And it really kind of brought multi-threading to the Ruby community. So I remember when I first started Sidekick, the big drawback to it was you had to ensure that all of your gems were thread safe. And that was scary. And so that was built a bit of an uphill climb where I had to convince people, hey, the gems will get fixed. You just need to open issues. And within 6 months or a year, the ecosystem will be a lot better. And then we'll have this, you know, much more efficient system that we can rely on. And yeah, it took a year or two, but now we're so much better off for it now.
That's awesome. Do you think a lot of just thread safe code in our ecosystem came from just people adopting Sidekick?
I think that was the main driver of finding thread safety bugs in the Rails ecosystem for a long time. I remember that Sidekick exposed a number of bugs in Active Record thread safety around the Rails 3.0, 3.1, 3.2 sort of timeframe. And then by the time Rails 4 came out, Sidekick was so pervasive that typically any threading bugs in Rails would be found before the release, the stable release. People that would be running on Rails Master would quickly uncover them. And so, yeah, it's really stabilized the thread safety of Rails because it's become so omnipresent.
And when you started Sidekick, did you have plans of it becoming paid tiers, things like that, or was it just purely an open source project at the time?
I was a big blogger at the time. I think that's how people also knew me, was I was blogging a lot. And so I was in a lot of people's RSS feeds talking about Ruby open source and sort of how I was improving things. And I also publicly blogged about how Sidekick was an experiment in finance for me, because I had done enough open source projects by this time that I realized that burnout was a pervasive issue. And that if Sidekick became successful, I would quickly burn out because I would just have so much support. And so I blogged about how I was going to run some financial experiments with the project, and I was going to try and sell licenses. I was going to try and sell maybe an open core model. And that is what turns out stuck, was the open core model was leaving Sidekick open, but selling a closed source Sidekick Pro and Sidekick Enterprise.
Seems to have been a decent experiment long term.
The initial selling of licenses didn't work out that well, but when I moved to the open core, I immediately had a dozen customers who bought. So I knew that there was some demand there. I just wasn't sure long-term how many customers there would be. Am I going to get 100 customers overall? Am I going to get 1,000, 10,000? I had no idea of what the size of the Ruby on Rails ecosystem was, but it turns out there's enough to support me in my business. So it worked out.
When you kind of moved to this open core model, did you have both the pro and an enterprise license at the time, or were there just like one license?
No, that's also evolved over time too. I initially sold for $500 one time, and that was it. Like, people could just have Sidekick Pro for $500. And I quickly realized that if I'm going to maintain Sidekick for the next 10 years, I'm going to need people to be paying every year to keep those bug fixes, to keep improvements flowing steadily. Otherwise, over time, everybody would buy it and then nobody new would be coming into the community and my income would dry up. So I increased the price to $750 and I increased it to $950. I moved from one time to annual. And then once I went solo and actually started doing it full time as my own business, I then introduced Sidekick Enterprise, which moved from a all-you-can-eat sort of pricing model for Sidekick Pro to a usage base. So the larger your cluster of the Sidekicks in production, the more your license price is. So I guess more of a usage pricing model.
So I had heard about Sidekick a lot in my first job, my first professional Rails job. I think we used Rescue maybe. And so I didn't, you know, really have a chance to use Sidekick except on personal projects. And it's just recently that at Podia, we migrated to Sidekick Enterprise. And it was like this, I don't know, it was like this whole world was unlocked for us, because these problems we kind of have at scale, all of a sudden we had solutions for. And like the one I tweet about, and we've talked on Twitter about, for example, and I think that's a pro feature maybe, not even an enterprise feature. I don't know. It's interesting because it feels like there's this level of programming where it's like, oh, we can actually put things in the background in Rails, and we can put, I don't know, quite a bit in the background and things are good. And then it's, you keep unlocking these worlds and it's really cool. And I love it.
It's the age old question of build versus buy. I like to tell people that I don't sell anything that you can't get as an open source extension somewhere. GitHub has a vast array of third-party Sidekick plugins. What I do sell, though, is a dozen plugins which are all integrated well together and maintained. And that's what you can't get with open source, is you can't get good maintenance and good support.
That was a question I've been curious to ask, is when you're searching for things about Sidekick, if I'm looking for API docs on, like, I don't know, batches, right? I'll see like other libraries that aren't from Sidekick, but they're like Sidekick Dash, and it's like open source versions. Do you ever feel that like, that is any kind of like issue for your business?
There's the question of trademark, and are you confusing somebody by marketing a gym as Sidekick Dash, whatever. I tend to be reasonably permissive. What I tell people is I maintain the Sidekick project, Sidekick Pro, and Sidekick Enterprise. Everything else is third party and I don't provide any support for it. I don't say anything good about it. I don't say anything bad about it. It just is. It's something that's out there, that if people want to use it, that's their choice. But what I do tend to do is tell people, if they're using third-party plugins, that I don't know what that could do to the rest of the system. Any gem can destabilize functionality, can add a memory leak, can add CPU performance issues. You just don't know, right? Because the Ruby ecosystem is so, you can monkey patch anything in Ruby, right? So you just don't know what that's going to do. So if someone is using a third-party plugin and they're having problems, I tell them, well, you can open an issue with that project and see if they can help. But I'm not making any guarantees or warranties if you're throwing in sort of random extensions.
I actually have an example of that. I was working on an application one time and we were having memory problems with the application and I was kind of new on the team. So I added in a few random tools. I can't remember them off the top of my head to find the memory leaks and try to diagnose what was going on. And it was a third-party Sidekick plugin that was causing the majority of the memory leaks. So,
yeah. Yeah, it happens. I mean, I'm not saying it's frequent, but again, it's one of those things where you just can't predict it. You don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I imagine it's incredibly difficult for you to even try and offer support for that because it's something you're not familiar with.
Trouble supporting my own stuff and making sure it works well with everything to bring in a whole new other set of projects that I don't control or maintain and have no say in. That's a bit of a tall order.
Along those lines, how does Active Job play into all of this for you?
Yeah, so Active Job it's a sort of a lowest common denominator API to make all background systems look alike, but it's just that, it's lowest common denominator. It can't support the full breadth of all the Sidekick functionality that I provide. So I like to tell people, listen, you can use Active Job and use that to port to Sidekick, but if you're using ActiveJob with Sidekick, what's your intent there? Are you planning to migrate to some other system? And if so, what possible system in the future? I don't know. By using ActiveJob, you're also possibly losing a bunch of Sidekick functionality. Again, it's almost like that going back to the third-party Sidekick plugin thing, which is I don't control ActiveJob. I don't know what directions it's going to go in the future. So I tell people I will make Sidekick work as good as I can with it, but I'm a third party to ActiveJob. They have to make sure that ActiveJob works with DelayJob, Rescue, all the other systems out there. So there's a lot of Sidekick functionality that they simply can't support. And it's difficult for me to make that functionality work natively with ActiveJob as opposed to my own APIs, which I have 100% control over.
It makes a lot of sense that Rails wants to provide a way to send emails by default in the background. And having a very simple wrapper around background jobs makes sense, but when it comes to being deliberate about writing background jobs and things, like, you almost always are going to want to go directly to Sidekick or whatever you're using because you can take advantage of all of those features like they were built and intended to be used.
Yeah, exactly. There's some philosophical differences between ActiveJob and Sidekick, and those are things which are just distinct design choices between the authors. ActiveJob allows you to do keyword arguments. It allows you to send full objects across the wire, whereas Sidekick specifically documents don't do that. Go down to the basic data types and tries to keep more compatibility with JSON so that you get compatibility across languages. Now you can create Sidekick jobs in PHP and push a payload to Redis from PHP so that Sidekick and Ruby can pick it up. And as long as it's just native JSON, that interoperability is built in. That's something ActiveJob does not necessarily document or stress. I prefer the interoperability of having multiple languages because you just never know what people are going to be running in their business applications. Your applications evolve over time. You may use one programming language. You may have to integrate with another programming language. That's the kind of thing that I'm thinking about.
It's interesting to hear you like actually explain that because I've used Sidekick on every application I've ever worked on. And I have almost primarily used it through ActiveJob. But the first time that we were using it without ActiveJob, like I know the basic difference, these are workers, ActiveJob calls them jobs and like small things like that. But passing in the objects was one thing that caught me off guard because I was so used to passing objects to the job. And then like in the job, I may set up some stuff, but I think it helped me write better code because instead of doing that setup in the job, which it doesn't really make sense to do, you set up that what you need to send to the job somewhere else where it probably better belongs. And then you just send that message to Sidekick versus passing in the object and doing some manipulation in there.
Yeah. And what Rails doesn't tell you is that when you send that object across the wire, you're not actually sending that distinct object, right? So if you set a bunch of instance variables in that object, those are not getting serialized and going over the wire. It's literally just passing the ID over the wire, just like you would do a Sidekick anyways, if you were to do it manually. So you're losing that state. The object is essentially just the wrapper. So yeah, it's that kind of, what is it? Policy of least surprise is a sort of a development mantra. Sidekick, I like to be a little more explicit than I think Rails likes to be. Rails is a little too magical for my tastes, but that's one example of it.
we're kind of finding now, because we've been active job folks at Podia, and now we're writing jobs that aren't, like, they're just pure sidekick jobs, because we want to utilize the new enterprise and pro features we have. So we're kind of at this weird crossroads where it's, we have a jobs folder with two different APIs, and which one do you call? And it kind of makes me want to argue for maybe let's abandon active job and go more towards the sidekick model.
There's no reason why you can't run both in parallel. You can always have a jobs folder with your AJs, and you can have a workers folder with your sidekick workers. And that way it's clear to anybody who's looking at the code base what mindset to get into when you're, if you're going to create an active job, you put it in this folder, you've got access to this sort of functionality. And if it's in the workers, then you can do this other stuff. It's not to say you can't do both.
Sure. So along those lines, we've got Sidekick, which I feel like everyone in the Ruby and Rails community knows and loves. And then you have another product, though, called Factory. And at first glance, like, I see, oh, it has support for other languages other than Ruby. But more than that, where did Factory come from? What is it? And would it be any use to us as Ruby developers to choose over Sidekick?
So Factory came from my just desire to bring Sidekick to every language, every programming language. So that's the question to you guys. If you wanted to bring the Sidekick design patterns and infrastructure to every language, how would you do it? And so Factory is my attempt to do that. It is background jobs that can be executed by any programming language. And it does that by providing a job server that worker processes can pull jobs from. And a lot of the functionality that you find in Sidekick and Sidekick Pro and Sidekick Enterprise is built into that server. So all the worker processes know how to do is pull jobs and execute them. And it's a light shim that any programming language can implement. And then most of the job functionality is implemented within the Factory service itself. So yeah, we have worker libraries to execute jobs in half a dozen different of the major languages. I'm thinking Python, JavaScript, Elixir. Well, of course, I support Ruby and Go languages, worker libraries in those languages. So those are first party. And then the open source community provides libraries for Python, JavaScript, Elixir, that sort of thing. So does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that helps kind of clear that up. How is the adoption of that compared to something like Sidekick?
The issue with Factory, it's been slower going. And I think the issue with Factory, because it doesn't target any one community, no one community has picked it up and run with it. When I introduced Sidekick, I was very focused on the Ruby community, obviously. And so the Ruby community quickly sort of saw it as the best up-and-coming system out there and sort of quickly adopted it. That hasn't necessarily been the case for Factory. So it's been a little bit tougher getting growth and picking up the speed of adoption, that sort of thing. One thing that I'm doing that I'm going to release, the next big release of Factory, is until now, Factory started a Redis instance as a child process and used that Redis instance to persist its data. And the issue there is that Factory had to manage the Redis. And so people were asking, like, what do I do about high availability? What do I do if that node goes down that's running Factory? Do I lose all my data? And I didn't really have a good answer for that, aside from job queues are typically empty. So if a node does go down during your normal operations, your job queues should be empty and you shouldn't lose much. But the next version is going to add support for bring your own Redis. So you'll be able to just pass Factory a Redis URL, and it, let's say, an ElastiCache instance in an AWS data center, and Factory will use that as its Redis. And now you have ElastiCache instance that AWS guarantees is backed up and will fail over if there's some sort of problem. I think that will pick up adoption because now I have got a good story around high availability and that sort of thing. We'll see how it goes, but that's what's coming soon.
That's awesome. I actually was thinking about something when you were talking about all the different languages who've written libraries like Python and stuff like that. There was, I would say, maybe an experiment you did a while back with Sidekick and Crystal. Am I remembering that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm curious how that went. Is that something you still have any interest in, or is it just kind of exists?
Right. So what happened there, that sort of was the early days of my thought experiment of how do I bring Sidekick to every other language? And so I started writing Sidekick.js, and I realized I am way in over my head because I don't know JavaScript and the code sucked and I hated every minute of it. So I quickly abandoned that. And instead I said, well, let's find a language that's somewhat akin to Ruby. And so I adopted Crystal, and it turned out it worked really well. There were a couple places where the staticness of Crystal was very much apparent versus the dynamism of Ruby. With Ruby, you can dynamically dispatch to anything, anytime. You can eval and that sort of thing. Crystal can't do that. Crystal, everything has to be statically compiled ahead of time. And that's how it's so fast. But the problem is that you can't, you have to dynamically dispatch to a worker class. The crux is constantize. With Ruby, you can say constantize on a string and that'll give you the class. And then you can just say new on that class and call perform on it. Crystal cannot do that. And so what you do is you wind up building an executable that just is basically if this, then do this. If that, then do that. Your constantize becomes a giant if else block with all the known worker names. Anyways, that's getting deep into the weeds. The fundamental issue, though, I found was that I was having to rebuild Sidekick in that language. And then I'd have to rebuild it in Python. Then I'd have to rebuild it in JavaScript. And that did not scale. I can't do every single ecosystem. So I instead flipped the architecture. And instead of providing a worker process that knows everything and just talks directly to Redis, I instead created a service called Factory that uses Redis internally, but that means the worker process is really dumb and doesn't implement any of the functionality. It's the server that knows about the queues and knows how to do all the logic around jobs and retries and that sort of thing. So kind of similar to like SQS, AWS. SQS is a service and it implements all the things like retries. And so you as a worker pulling jobs off of SQS, you don't think about the queuing and the retries and all that kind of stuff. You just say, give me a job, and then either acknowledge it as successful or it fails and it times out. So that was how I decided to go long-term was I'm not going to build in language-specific libraries. I'm going to build one service in Go and ship that. And so Factory is written in Go and implements all that functionality.
Chris, you know what really just bugs me?
It seems like it's on the tip of my tongue.
Bugs.
Oh, dang it. I knew it.
All bugs. Real bugs. Bugs in my app. Bugs Bunny. Anything with a bug in it bugs me.
I can see why.
So I'm asking Chris for your professional opinion as a thought leader in the industry. How should I handle these bugs?
You know, I learned in school that honey badgers are really good at helping with bug problems.
Do you mean a literal honey badger?
Or maybe honeybadger.io.
But if I sign up for Honey Badger, what do I get?
Well, something that is really useful that actually just saved my butt the other day was their uptime monitoring. I was doing an update on one of my apps and made a deploy and didn't notice right away that it went down. So that was a really good, useful feature there. Not to mention that they've got your error monitoring for those bugs.
Bugs.
Yeah. So, yeah. You should go check out Honey Badger, it sounds like.
Sounds like it.
I know Honey Badger did this, so I'm just kind of curious. Did you ever consider just hiring out contractors to build the specific libraries in a given language?
I did. I thought about it for a little bit. And I'm still thinking about that long term. If Factory becomes a success long term, and I'm finding that people can't get support for the worker libraries that are in the language that they want to use, then I could contract someone to maintain them. And to me, that would look like what you're talking about with Honey Badger, or it might look like what Ruby Together does, where they just pay $150 an hour to anybody who wants to contribute to the project. And that way these libraries do get regular maintenance. They get any new features implemented in them, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's crossed my mind. So far, the need hasn't been there. Thankfully, the people that maintain these gems are typically using them in production, and they recognize that any bugs that need to be fixed will help them too. So it's in their own self-interest to maintain them. So yeah, I haven't had too much of an issue with project abandonment yet. We'll see what that looks like long-term though.
So one thing I would like to shift gears to now is how you've turned Sidekick and Factory into your full-time gig. It's kind of like the dream story for some of us developers. I'd be curious just to hear kind of maybe when you knew this is what I can do full time. I don't necessarily need whatever you're doing before. And yeah, just some of the, as you mentioned earlier before we started recording, some of the economics around it. I'd just be curious to hear about that.
So I think a lot of my business came out of the imposter syndrome. I've never thought of myself as a business guy. I've never thought of myself as a manager and someone who wants to hire. I've never wanted to put together a pitch deck and pitch VCs and investors. And so all of my business and all of my policies come out of me wanting to do this on my own, because I don't feel like it's too risky to risk other people's jobs on my own little thing. And it probably won't work. So I'm just going to do this on my own and scale it as far as I can on my own and see what happens. And so I've always said, I don't really want to hire anybody because I don't want to manage. I don't want to risk somebody's livelihood on my thing. I'll take the risk myself, but I don't want to put others through it. And so that's why you get all of these policies that I have, where I basically do everything myself. And I try to push people into self-service as much as possible so that I scale as far as possible. And so, yeah, all my sales are, I should say, like 75% of my sales are through credit card self-service. So I don't ever enter the picture there. People buy it. They are granted access. And then a year later, if they don't resubscribe, they're removed and it's all automated. So yeah, I'm sort of an unanticipated business success. I'd probably be the first guy to say this isn't going to work. Despite my best efforts, I like to joke, the business just grows 25, 30, 40% every year. And I don't do any marketing. The only marketing I do is improving my documentation, putting out regular releases with new features or bug fixes. I blog about what I'm doing. I tweet about what I'm doing. I do happy hours and I do these podcasts to talk about what I'm doing. So in that way, I'm sort of marketing myself and the products. But I'm doing it to try and provide ultimately a tool that is valuable to my fellow developers and so that they can build their own business.
Yeah, I'll never forget more context that you almost ever know. But I was at a conference in my hotel room and I was scrolling my phone in the restroom and I read an Hindi Hackers article you had released. I remember saying, oh, like Mike is here at this conference I'm at. And I just read this article about like how successful it is. And I don't know, it was just so fascinating. And that's really... that's probably one of the earlier points in my life where I was like, I want to learn how to build products. This is really cool.
If you can build a product that's useful to a lot of people and you can sell it through self-serve so that you're not entering into every transaction yourself, it scales unbelievably. I'm at several million dollars a year now in sales and I'm the only employee. So what's in the bank account at the end of the month just transferred into my personal bank account. I mean, that's just, it's as simple as that.
Wow.
So software is unbelievably easy to scale and it's unbelievably profitable if you do it right. So the trick is just to have those policies and that allow you to scale on your own. But that's why I laugh and I kind of feel sad at the same time whenever I see a software company taking venture capital, because if you can make it valuable enough, quick enough, you can just bootstrap it yourself and then all the profit's yours. You don't have to pay some dude in a suit who just signed you a check for $100,000 and now you got to give them 5% of every dollar you make. It's a different way of thinking about the world, but I'm a big fan of bootstrappers and indie hackers.
That blog post, I remember reading that too and having the same reaction. And that was like, having been working for consulting companies for a long time, everybody who ran the consulting companies was like trying to get into doing a product, but you have to pay for those salaries and it takes a while to get one salary from a product and then two and whatever. And it is a tough battle. And it always is easier to go get another consulting client when you've got multiple people. So your blog post is always a giant inspiration for me, because I was like, that same thing is not appealing to me about raising money and selling part of my company to investors and then having to make a return on that for them. And it, you just give yourself a job at that point, which is not the point. Like, a lot of people are, they want the independence, and you just sold that to the investors. It's such a strange idea.
Well, but, Chris, I got to say, you're pretty inspiring yourself. You've got so many different irons in the fire and so many different products that you're always constantly throwing out there into the world. I mean, the most recent one I was looking at was the page, the pay Rails mm-hmm. engine. I think that's got a huge amount of potential. I don't really know how that corresponds to Bullet Train and other sort of application scaffolds or frameworks. But I mean, if you put yourself in the direct path of payments, that's an easy one to make a good amount of money on. If you make it really easy for people to charge people money, that sells itself.
Yeah, I feel like Stripe itself is a really good example of that. That was like their whole goal, and now they're $11 billion or something valuation. And it's the same philosophy that I think I feel like I picked up from you, which was like, go build something free that's valuable and helps people, and then have your premium version of it that you can offer extra support or extra features or whatever that is that are maybe not as commonly needed for everybody. And Jumpstart is kind of that. I don't have a premium version of the PayGem itself, but like Jumpstart's a Rails template with payments already built in and accounts and stuff. And so it's kind of the natural, if you don't want to go integrate the PayGem by itself, here it is. It's already done for you. And yeah, there's kind of countless things you can probably figure out of other features or whatever it might be to make life easier for people. Like, they want to go build all these different things, go find one of those that's valuable and make it easier. And if you can do it for free with a premium version, there's built-in marketing for you, which is really nice.
Today's advanced infrastructure or premium infrastructure is tomorrow's foundational requirement. If you can make something that is widely adopted, all of a sudden you're part of the core infrastructure of an ecosystem. And certainly I think there's tons of bootstrappers out there that rely on Rails to get their stuff built as quickly and as simply as possible. And doing things like recurring billing, you could just be part of the starter widget that every bootstrapper wants to use and charge $1,000, $2,000 for that. And then boom, they've got a month's worth of building paid for and available to them. So I think you've got a lot of potential in what you've built already.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's funny to finally sit down and chat, because I remember looking up to you for a long time after reading your blog posts and stuff. And that was the dream. I want to do something where it's just me or a small team. Like, I don't want necessarily 10 people relying on me for salaries and all that. That's a lot of stuff that it's a different job, a totally different job.
Yeah. So, well, with Go Rails, you've got a marketing platform, you've got a system to with a lot of viewers and a lot of listeners. So, yeah, I mean, you've got a built in audience, sort of like I had my blog early on. I had a big audience early on for promoting Sidekick and building that. So, yeah, I think you're placed really well to be a success moving forward.
Yeah, the audience is definitely very valuable. It kind of anything that you want to test out, you have hopefully hundreds of or thousands of people like willing to go check it out day one, rather than going around one by one trying to convince people to try it. And I think that is, it's not easy to build the audience, but it is your secret superpower once you have it.
Yeah, the nice thing about an audience is you build trust with them and they trust you. So when you come out with something brand new that nobody's ever seen before, if nobody knows who you are, nobody's going to do anything with it. But if they know who you are and they trust you, they'll take a look at it and they'll play with it and they'll say, hey, this is kind of cool and solves a problem I have. And boom, now you've got a user. And that's the greatest feeling in the world. So yeah,
totally.
Yeah, keep going with it. You're doing great so far.
Do you think it makes sense that people should build stuff? Or I guess you could say that writing blog posts is a sort of a free thing you're giving out to people, but also you could totally just build a really good gem that people use that solves whatever problem. You can build trust in a lot of different ways. And I think it probably needs to be something kind of free like that so that you can basically just educate people on here's the right way to think about background workers or payments or whatever it is. It doesn't have to be writing a blog or whatever. It could be lots of creative things, your Twitter account even.
Yeah, there's different approaches for sure. Someone who I don't think does much in the way of writing or building an audience, but who is widely trusted is Jeremy Evans of SQL fame. The dude just cranks out code all the time. And to the best of my knowledge, he does not blog much or tweet much. I could be wrong. Maybe I just don't follow the right circles to see his output. But I think of him as somebody who is widely trusted by the Ruby community, but who does not necessarily actively try and get an audience. He's just accumulated this audience over a decade of putting out high quality gems all the time. So yeah, he's a good example of someone who just seems to do it for the philanthropy and the enjoyment. He's not looking to monetize anything. And to each their own, everybody's got their own path that they're going to go down and their own approach.
Yeah, I would say Andrew Kane does some blogging, but he's just churning out gem after gem on Search Kick and machine learning and just all kinds of amazing quality stuff. And he's another person like that, that I think does tremendous work and has gotten a good following just because of the fantastic work that he's put out there, open source and all that.
Well, I like to say that throwing out high quality stuff into the world doesn't matter if people don't know about it and people don't know how to use it. And so teaching is important. And I think if I were to give one piece of advice to those guys, it would be, hey, communicate more, educate, write more long form pieces about what you're trying to do with this. How does it work? Why does it achieve your goals? Why do you think it's better than X, Y, and Z? Because the more you educate people, they will start to trust you and they'll implicitly like you and want to help you because you've helped them by teaching them.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, that is not something I realized when I started doing screencasts. I was just like, I miss Ryan Bates and Railscast and all that. And I was like, maybe that's an idea I could have for a product or whatever. And here we are. But the thing I never deliberately did was I ended up teaching, but I didn't on purpose realize that, yeah, that is the perfect way to build trust. Just teach people stuff. That is the way to do it.
Well, Mike, we really appreciate you joining us today. Is there anything else you want to chat about or anything else before we sign off?
I don't think we ever did really explain what Sidekick actually is.
Andrew, you're up.
So Sidekick is a Ruby-based framework to perform background jobs, basically. It's written in Ruby. It's for Rubyists. It works amazing in Rails. But I've also seen it used in Sinatra applications. And obviously with Factory, you can use it elsewhere. And it's basically for handling like expensive computations or things that are going to like long-running jobs and things like that. And you can use it as a part of active job, but as we kind of discuss here, you lose out on some of the benefits.
Yeah, I think of, to speak more generically of background jobs in general, I think of background jobs as sort of a unit of work for your business. So if you want to accept a form, or if you want to transcode an image or send an email, all of these things are sort of units of work that your business needs to do for some reason. And Sidekick is sort of a generic framework for doing anything asynchronously as a single unit of work. And then it provides just APIs on top of that to do tons of stuff. So you can do groups of 100,000 jobs as a group, like what's known as a batch, right? So you have things like cron jobs, so you can fire a job every hour or every minute. There's a lot of different things you can do once you have that distinct unit of work. That there's lots of different edge cases and features and whatnot that you can build around that. And of course, it gives you monitoring capabilities. It gives you a web UI so you can sort of see what's happening in real time, that sort of thing. Yeah, it turned out to be a lot bigger than what I was first expecting when I first started building it. But it's kept me employed for the past almost decade.
Go solve some little problem and you're going to have users continually asking for, hey, can we do this? Can we do that? And that's where all these things probably came from with Sidekick Pro and Enterprise, didn't they?
I was absolutely solving my own problem, yes. I built Sidekick because I was trying to build a better thing than the various solutions I was previously working on. I built Sidekick Pro and those more advanced features like batches precisely because I needed them at the job I was working in. And so I like to say that my first customer was my employer, because every feature that I rolled out, we were using in production a week later. I was literally figuratively eating my own dog food. But you know, that's where it came from, is I rolled out these features in production and then I was selling them the next week as part of Sidekick Pro. And so there's no better way to build a business than to solve your own problem and then roll it out so that other people can use your solution too.
I love that. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Mike, once again, very much appreciate it. It was fun to chat with you. Please feel free to join us anytime.
Thanks for having me, guys. I will come back anytime, especially when maybe when I've got some big news or something like that. Maybe I could use you as a promotion vehicle for further marketing in the future.
Yeah, we would love that.
All right, Brad. Cool.
All right. Well, yeah. We will talk to everyone next week.
Later.
Bye, guys.
See ya.